What seems perfectly ethical to me might strike you as completely wrong. But when the public good and political leaders are involved, room for interpretation can lead to corruption if the rules are not clear. Joining us to have that conversation is Jessica Tillotman. She is Assistant Dean for Field Placement and Professorial Lecturer in Law at the George Washington University Law School. She teaches an anti-corruption seminar. Jessica Tillotman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio is Gordon Witkin. He is Executive Editor of the Center for Public Integrity, an award-winning nonprofit journalism outlet based here in Washington. Gordon Witkin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The old saw goes, Jessica, you know it when you see it. How do you distinguish between what might be unethical versus what qualifies as corruption?
Well, I think legally it depends on what the law says. And in the United States, we have a variety of laws that govern these types of behaviors, whether it's an ethics law or it's an anti-corruption law or criminal law. And we see that both at the federal level and the state level. And what's interesting in the distinction between the two is that we'll see that ethics laws often govern what I would refer to as the appearance of impropriety, just to make sure that the casual bystander or citizen won't suspect that corruption is occurring, whereas criminal laws tend to actually cover actual corruption or actual criminal activity.
Gordon, that seems to be particularly troublesome at the state and local levels, because talk about how state governments, even though they're held up as being closer to the people and where problems are solved at local and state government levels, but you're talking largely about part-time legislators in many of those cases. How does that affect the issue?
I think dramatically. I'm here, I think, because we do a big project called the State Integrity Investigation, which ranks states according to 245 indicators of transparency and accountability. The whole part-time legislature is the so-called citizen legislature is a concept that I think many of us feel sort of warm and fuzzy about, the idea that actual citizens rather than career politicians would be making the decisions. In state legislatures, though, it's been found to be a big problem in terms of the conflicts of interest between their legislative duties and their full-time jobs or consultancies. And what we found is that these conflicts of interest are rampant, but also that it is largely up to the legislators themselves to decide when they're going to recuse themselves because they have a conflict of interest. And I would submit that that doesn't work particularly well. We cited one specific example in which a legislator proposed a bill to try to ban localities from themselves banning plastic bags in grocery stores. Well, he has a right to do that, you'd think, but it also happens that his full-time job is he's executive director of the State Grocers Association. So I think there's a legitimate question as to whether someone in that position doesn't have a conflict of interest.
And you pointed out also that a lot of these laws at the state level are designed to be weak. Funding for enforcement purposes decided by the very legislators they would theoretically be investigating?
We found this particularly true in regard to statewide ethics commissions or ethics enforcement bodies. Many of these bodies were dramatically underfunded with very little professional staff. Some did not have subpoena power. Some did not have professional investigators on the staff. Some had seen their funding cut. And when you look into that, it is partly in some places because the people who are likely to be investigated by these groups, the lawmakers themselves, are the ones who control the purse strings.
Jessica, how much of corruption falls to state and local governments to suss out and prosecute, and how much of it is under federal purview?
As I like to say in law school, it depends. it really does depend in certain situations. Every single state in the United States prohibits corruption or prohibits bribery. So that is on the books, and there are many different jurisdictions and most jurisdictions that will take cases and enforce cases that involve state and local corruption. However, the federal government also has its own anti-corruption laws, and many of them do apply to state and local behavior. The question becomes, when does the federal government get involved? And it does routinely, oftentimes in high-profile cases, when it can make its case, of course. And you can see the importance of having the federal government step in or the Department of Justice step in these instances. Because if you can imagine, for the same issue we're talking about before, sometimes there's not a big separation between those that may have to prosecute the cases and those that have committed some of the crimes, especially when we're dealing with political figures. So having that separation and independence has enabled the federal government to step in certain situations. And also, if you know that the Department of Justice has enormous resources and a lot of experience when it comes to prosecuting high-profile corruption cases. But again, the state level still can do it as well.
With the Supreme Court taking up the case of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, there are prosecutors and defense attorneys, not to mention disgraced politicos around the nation, who are paying attention. What for you will be the biggest potential effect of this case, however the decision comes down?
Again, it matters how it comes down. If the decision is upheld, I think some people have said that this could, you know, broaden the ability of the United States government to go after any politician for any routine political activity. I think that's a little overbroad, and I don't think that's going to be the case. I think the biggest risk runs from the Supreme Court overturning the conviction or somehow construing the statute at issue so narrowly as to tie the hands of federal prosecutors going forward. In this particular instance, I think that the Fourth Circuit decision was very strong. There was a lot of evidence at hand, a trial. A jury found very well and strongly that Governor McDonald and his wife violated these laws. And I think that it was not a very complicated case. I think what will happen is this is somehow narrowed in its interpretation by the Supreme Court, that it will be difficult to prosecute cases like this going forward.
Gordon?
Yeah, I was going to just add, Kojo, that I think this is part of a larger debate at the Center for Public Integrity. We do a lot of coverage of money in politics and what the influence is. A lot of variance of opinion on that. But one of the things that this Supreme Court case will be helping to decide is where on the continuum does the quote unquote quid pro quo lie. In this case, those representing the governor will argue that he was simply doing a kind of innocuous favor that a politician would do for any benefactor. Traditionally, the line has been drawn is if there is an explicit behavior engaged in the politician's explicit capacity that is directly in exchange for the cash. So the Supreme Court may move that line in effect, and I think that's going to really have a lot of resonance in all these cases across the country.
800-433-8850. Are you closely following the McDonald case as it goes to the Supreme Court? What interests you most about it? You can also send us email to kojo@wamu.org, or tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. Our own Patrick Madden has done a lot of work exposing shady deals in the district. McDonald's case unfolded in the pages of the Washington Post. Gordon, you have spent your entire adult life in the journalism business. How concerned are you about the fact that the media under financial pressure is cutting jobs and that results in not covering state houses and local jurisdictions as much as we used to?
Yeah, this was actually part of the foundation, Kojo, for why we did this state integrity investigation, which we've now done twice, and why we were able to get support for doing it. I think it's popular right now, and I happen to agree, that a lot more of the action is moving to the state level because the federal government, particularly Congress, seems so gridlocked. And so what's happening at the state level is more and more important. We're about to launch a separate investigation looking at state-level lobbying and how dramatically it's grown. But to your question, this movement of more of the action to the states is happening at the same moment that state house coverage, particularly serious state house coverage, has really been decimated. So you have a situation potentially where more and more of importance to the whole country is happening at the state level, and fewer people are watching.
Jessica, the U.S. has a reputation for trying to bolster ethics reforms, especially in developing nations. Do you see a kind of hypocrisy here, since it seems as if we're having so many problems policing ourselves?
I think it definitely be viewed that way internationally. The question comes to what type of message are we providing abroad and what message are we signaling domestically? And I think with our extreme actions, not even extreme, but extraordinary actions abroad, pushing other countries through multilateral agreements to ramp up their own anti-corruption enforcement. Perhaps if we see a more narrow interpretation of some of our weakening of some of our anti-corruption laws domestically, it could send a mixed message to some of our partners abroad. And I think it's particularly telling in this case. Now, what I will say is that many of these prosecutions abroad under statutes like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act are driven by the Department of Justice. And in this instance, particularly in the McDonald case, I don't see the Department of Justice being shy about bringing cases forward domestically, and I'm definitely not abroad. But what we're seeing is the Supreme Court's interpretations in recent years of domestic anti-corruption statutes narrowing their application so dramatically that it could inhibit future enforcement domestically. So while I do think that the U.S. will continue to push other countries to ramp up their enforcement of their own statutes, it could send a problematic message if our own laws are weakening at the same time.
Given the conversation we just had with the mayor of Alexandria, Alison Silberberg, Gordon, to what extent do you feel it is the responsibility of local jurisdictions? She says Alexandria wants to become a national model for both transparency and for ethics. To what extent can should local jurisdictions be following that pattern?
Well, a local jurisdiction like Alexandria, as you intimated in your interview, has lots going on. And there are a lot of things to do, and there are a lot of priorities. But I think for almost any local jurisdiction, it would help to know what the rules of the road are and to have explicit rules laid out regarding ethics, conflicts of interest, lobbying, what's permitted and what's not. Because then you, in effect, draw a bright line, and people know where to go to look for the bright line.
How do we do that at the state level?
Well,
especially with the conflict of interest situation.
Yeah. I mean, I think we see some glimmers of hope. In a number of states, there are groups of legislators and reform groups that are sensing this phenomena I referenced earlier, i.e. more action at the states, less oversight. And they are requiring, more specific quantification of exactly what's permitted and what's not. But that is a one step forward, one step back kind of situation. I would cite in specifically New York, where they've been talking about ethics reform a lot in the last few years, and where something like 14 legislators have been convicted. It's been a poisonous culture. But slowly they are starting to lay out more specific rules regarding contributions, conflict of interest, etc.
So, but that comes in an environment, Jessica, in which we are seeing more and more money in politics in general and in political campaigns in particular, and especially in the wake of the Citizens United decision. How does that make it more problematic, if you will, to police ethics?
I think it definitely makes it more difficult. The United States government or lawmakers have carved out exceptions for campaign contributions, but that does not lessen the appearance of impropriety that we've been discussing. And I think, again, if we want to get back to the message that the United States is sending, on one hand, we're saying we're tough on corruption. We're going to prosecute corruption to the fullest extent. On the other hand, we are having interpretations coming out of the Supreme Court once again that are opening up the floodgates to almost unlimited campaign contributions. This sends a very difficult message when we are in front of other countries basically telling them, do as we say, not as we do. And I think that's going to continue to be a problem until things start to change.
Jessica Tillipman is Assistant Dean for Field Placement and Professorial Lecturer in Law at the George Washington University Law School. She teaches an anti-corruption seminar. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Gordon Witkin is Executive Editor of the Center for Public Integrity, an award-winning nonprofit journalism outlet based in Washington. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, can coffee be a local product? It's a conversation we'll have. You can join it by calling 800-433-8850, telling us what you think. I'm Kojo Namdi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kodjo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.